Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite all students to go next door to our office or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. Today, the Hinckley Institute is celebrating the book release of Professor Ella Myers. Professor Myers' book is titled Worldly Ethics, Democratic Politics, and Care for the World, and was published by Duke University Press. I'll now introduce you to Professor Mark Button, Associate Professor of Political Science, who will introduce the rest of our panelists. Please join me in welcoming Professor Button.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. This is a great showing. I'm appreciative of you all being here. I want to thank the Department of Political Science, the Gender Studies Program, and the Hinckley Institute of Politics for co-sponsoring this event. And I also want to put a plug in for the University Bookstore, who are providing discounted copies of the book we're going to be discussing today. So please, if you haven't had a chance to do so yet, pick one up. Ella might just sign one if you ask nicely. What I'm going to do is just very briefly introduce the other members of the panel here, provide just a very brief summary of the book in case you all haven't had a chance to read it yet, just kind of give you a sense of what the book is doing, and then turn it over to the other panelists who have all been asked to provide comments and questions, just about 10 to 12 minutes each. We'll ask, or at least invite, Ella to respond to our comments, and then open it up to all of you for conversation and questions. And I know that not having read the material will not keep you from participating, because we know that it doesn't keep you from participating in regular courses. That's not a secret. So very briefly, our guest of honor, Ella Myers, is Assistant Professor of Political Science and Gender Studies, the author of this book that we're here to discuss, Worldly Ethics. She's also published in journals such as the Review of Politics and Contemporary Political Theory. Edmund Fong is Assistant Professor of Political Science and Ethnic Studies, whose publications have appeared in Politics, Groups, and Identities and the Political Research Quarterly. Angela Smith, seated in the middle, is Associate Professor of English and Gender Studies, who is the author most recently of Hideous Progeny, Disability, Eugenics, and Classic Horror Cinema, published with Columbia University Press. Now, for the benefit of those of you who have not yet had the chance to read Professor Myers' book, let me provide just a brief summary of the intellectual terrain and the central arguments of worldly ethics. She's here, so she'll catch me if I get anything wrong. But over the past several decades, scholars of democratic theory have shown a renewed interest in ethics and in the concept of ethos in particular. Ethos, for those of you who don't remember your Aristotle, refers to the collective spirit, the social norms, and the shared character that helps to spur and to shape human conduct. And in this case, in particular, our interest is in political practice. Among other things, the attention to ethos within contemporary political theory signals a commitment to take the habits and the dispositions of citizens seriously. And it conveys the further idea that politics cannot be reduced to the formal apparatus or channels of government. And let me just also say, I see a lot of students in the room, that this concept of ethos also tells you that figures like Aristotle, Montesquieu, and Tocqueville that your teachers make you read are still deeply relevant today, because all that material that they bring up is the work that's still going on very much in the present. Now, Myers' book is entering into this terrain with both critical and constructive intent. The critical thrust of the book aims to show what is missing in several influential attempts to connect ethics and ethos to democratic politics. The focus here is on Foucault and Levinas and several of their most prominent contemporary interpreters, and here we're talking about people like William Conley and Judith Butler. Myers shows that the persistent missing link in cultivated forms of care for the self, that's the late Foucault, and care for the other, that's Levinas, the missing link is to collective worldly care for democratic politics. And so if you've ever read Foucault and Levinas and thought that these characters were just totally unworldly, detached from worldly politics, then Myers is in your corner. And you will find great sustenance from those chapters. This takes us then to the heart of what Myers wants to do. And the heart of this book is really a democratic activist heart. Myers argues that a political theory concerned with ethics must have as its primary object of focus the worldly conditions within which people live, not therapeutic self-care or charitable care for the other. All those things are nice and important, but that's not what politics is about. These are not Myers' exact terms, these are mine, but I would say that for her, the ancient Greek concept of ethos must be tied to a Marxian structural analysis of material inequalities, or it risks ideological co-optation and or social or political irrelevance. So the compelling alternative that Myers presents, drawing upon the spirit, if not exactly the text, necessarily of Hannah Arendt, is animated by an interest in ethics and practices of care, but one that highlights the important role that democratic associations can and should play in caring for our shared social world. Care for the world means something specific here. It means a democratic ethos that entails collaborative caretaking for the basic material conditions of our lives. Democratic care must entail three things. It must be associative, that is, citizens working together. Secondly, it has to be oriented toward addressing material conditions that leaves basic human needs unmet for so many. And thirdly, it must seek to expand democratic participation and the opportunities to be involved in decision-making for all. Final thing I'll say is that she is fully aware that what I just said is going to sound unrealistic and impossible to you. And that's why she doesn't just elaborate a world-centered framework for a democratic ethos for our times. She also highlights a diverse array of political movements that embody and enact this worldly democratic spirit in practice every day. So that, I hope, is more than a dust jacket version of a summary, but enough to keep you wanting more. That was my goal. If I succeeded, you'll purchase copies when we're done. Now I'm going to invite Edmund, Angela, and then I will say a few things as well, and then we will turn it over to Ella. Okay? Thank you. Edmund.
All right. First of all, I'd just like to begin by expressing how honored I am to be a part of this gathering to discuss Professor Myers' book. What is sorely missing in the cynicism and apathy of our democratic politics, Ella tells us, is a renewed attention to the care of the world as a shared world. And only by attending to the objects of concern, this book being one example, that brings us together as well as divide us, can we hope to incite and invigorate a robust notion of collective association. And certainly this book, as an object of concern, fulfills the spirit of its argument in inciting us to come together and consider for ourselves our own partaking of the concerns manifested in the work. As Ella tells us, a deep pessimism pervades our democratic politics today. A pessimism about the prospects of collective democratic action in the presence of what appear to be deep partisan divisions on the one hand, and on the other, a world that seems overwhelming and alien. This has inspired, quote-unquote, an ethical turn, which Mark elaborated in contemporary political theory, and this ethical turn serves as the occasion for the arguments in Ella's book. Too often, Ella tells us, the ethical is figured as a supplement to politics, as supplying democracy with something that it cannot give to itself, recourse to an inner ethical focus or to an ethical reflection on the dyadic relationship between self and other might yield an alternative ground by which to reinvigorate the associative practices of democratic life. But the central argument of Ella's book, as I understand it, is that this is a vain, if sympathetic and understandable hope. Figured through the lens of a Foucauldian ethics of self-care, or a Levinasian ethics of charity towards the needs of the other, these ethical approaches are just as likely to reinforce an invasion of democratic association as they are to invigorate it. Just as likely to reinforce a hierarchical separation between self and other as occasion their associative practice together. A Foucauldian ethics of self-care leads to an inward focus on therapy, Ella argues, away from the objects and things of the world of contention between us. Worse, the relationship of self to self as one of self-mastery hardly serves to encourage us towards mutual and equitable forms of association. Likewise, in regards to a Levinasian ethics of charity to an other, locks us within a dyadic relationship that leaves no room for considering the world that always lies between us, much less encouraging us into collaborative action over what Ella calls a third term that is always not just about humans. Charity can easily slide into a reinforced understanding of unequal difference, with token efforts of attending the needs of the other without any transformative effect on that third term, on that world, on those conditions that create and reinforce the self-other relationship. Both kinds of ethical orientation lead us away from democratic associative practice. So what Ella proposes is that what we need is a renewed attention, a renewed care for the world that lies between us, but is also the condition of our coming together. It is a world as a shared home, but also a world that unites and divides. Worldly ethics demands care for the things of differential and plural concern that animate us into associative action. It's a notion of a world as world, as she puts it, that provides a condition for our coming together. Again, not in unanimity or false consensus, but also in differences that should impel us nevertheless to care for and enrich its possibilities for bringing us in relationship to one another. It's an enormously appealing conception. I will not try to recapitulate all the capacious dimensions that Ella argues should follow from a world-centered democratic ethics. I'm liable to get it wrong, if I haven't done so already. However, Ella's argument is by turns elegant and simple, but enormously expansive and densely argued. In our deep disagreements with each other or in our deep anxieties over ourselves, we lose sight of a very simple fact. The world in contention and of concern is that very basis which connects us. Unless we reattend and care for that shared connection, unless we accept that we are always already mediated by the objects and things around us, that it is not likely that we will engage in the labor, frustration, and love of collective association. To me, this is the great strength of Ella's book, the simple truth that the I and the we are brought together by the mediation of a world that concerns us. We cannot wish that mediation away, that thing that we contend over, by reducing it to an inward solipsism or some face-to-face demand between self and other. It is only in and through a shared but mediated notion of world that we come together, and this at least should encourage us to enrich as much as possible that shared participation in the democratic possibilities of the world between us. So in the spirit of engagement over the objects that concern us, in this case, this book, I do, however, have some questions and comments. First is about your reading of Foucault. Right? your reading of Foucault obviously concentrates on the late Foucault, on the ethics of self-care. But in doing so, particularly in sort of provocatively figuring him as yielding into an ethics of therapy, right, it seems to do somewhat violence to the middle or early Foucault, right, the Foucault of biopower and disciplinary power, right? It seems strange to figure Foucault perhaps as calling for a therapeutic engagement with the self, when his most famous works have been about how we are trapped within that sort of therapeutic inward engagement. Part of your critique of Foucault is that the late Foucault, the ethics of self-care, is a kind of retreat from the world, right? It's sort of an inward focus, right? But if we read, you know, the later Foucault, which is set in the three volumes of the history of sexuality that we have, that, you know, it's put in the context of a worldly problem of sexuality, right? And so I want to ask if you could clarify sort of how you see that, that sort of strange, perhaps even violent way you read Foucault.
I'm so excited.
And then a few questions and comments about the worldly ethics that you advocate. One is, why retain a focus on ethics or ethos? One of your arguments is that, you know, a focus on ethics is, as I set out, a kind of supplement to democratic politics, that it often tends to a kind of evasion of politics. And you critique Foucault and Levinas as not necessarily ensuring, as you put it, the rich democratic associations that are only implicit in their ethical orientations. But I wonder if the same can be said of the worldly ethics that you advocate, right? That there's nothing guaranteed, it seems to me, in recognizing that we live in a shared world in common, that it would lead us to encourage us to care for that world. Concern over the world can lead one to foreclose democratic possibility as much as invigorate it, in the sense that, well, there is a group of people that is threatening, you know, the object of concern between us, and therefore, if I'm concerned about the world, that therefore I want to deprive them of their position. So, again, I guess the question is whether your worldly ethics successfully evades or successfully overcomes the problem of evasion of politics that you situate as part of the ethical dilemma, right, or the ethical turn. Another set of questions is about whether the worldly ethics is sufficiently political. You know, repeatedly throughout the book, you frame the sort of encounter between, the associative encounter between between people as citizens, right? And the notion of citizen association, of course, is not a neutral term. It has its own history. It's driven by class, right? It has a certain standing, a certain inheritance. Whether this sort of perhaps tacit use of the language of citizens coming together is an impossible or illusory democratic ideal, not sufficiently political in its own right. One of the examples you give is of the debate over immigration, and that we should recognize that, you know, the object of concern, immigration, can be divided or fought over between seeing immigrants as undocumented or immigrants as illegal, right? But that way of framing the debate as one between citizens over immigrants, you know, leaves out precisely those people who are the objects of concern, right? That they have no standing as citizens to engage in this debate. So again, whether this is, this framing of the associative encounter is sufficiently political, okay? Related to this, You often charge Foucault, Levinas, and Butler with not enlivening the notion, a rich notion of democratic practice and debate, right? When in fact much of their work is about, again, the sort of illusion of the politics of democratic association, right? Their concern is with the forces of subjection that collapse, you know, this sort of ideal or utopia of democratic engagement, or they're focused on the normative violence that occludes and excludes people from the political arena, right? And so, you know, the charge that you level at them might be leveled at worldly ethics as well. Is a shared concern over the conditions of the world in common or in between always a desired political outcome? Right, politics is also about winners and losers. Right, that not everyone can have their say or have, you know, their object of concern lead to a practice. Right, one person's concern for the world is often at someone else's expense, not always. Or even not always undesirable, right? One of the issues, you know, in my class in racial and ethnic politics that we've been considering recently regarding the civil rights era is how Southern segregationists and civil rights activists invoked and deployed their own democratic language, defense of an object of concern. Right, and contention between them. And one had to give way to the other, even though it may be disputed which one actually won out in the end. Right. So again, you know, politics is often about winners and losers. Right. It is about competing interests that, you know, lead to some sort of outcome, if you will. And so a worldly ethics seems to imply in its capaciousness too much of a concern for being hospitable when, in fact, there are certain orientations to the world that are inhospitable, that, you know, need to be ruled out. Okay. And one last issue, right? There seems to be a kind of running argument in the background of the book about identity politics in the contemporary political era, right? That one of the sort of claims you make throughout the book is that in order for political claims to be worldly, right, that they have to be demands oriented to the world, right, that they have to be in relationship to a democratic movement, you put it, that they cannot precede a democratic movement, that they cannot be inward, solely inwardly focused, right? So there seems to be an argument against sort of identity politics, which can lead to a kind of claim that, you know, is familiar over the past few decades that, you know, well, what do they demand, right? Don't, you know, give me your sort of subaltern identity claims. Don't sort of impose your, you know, guilt upon the rest of society. And I'm being obviously provocative here. But, you know, translate your rage, frustration into clear, pragmatic, practical demands of us in the world in order for us to recognize you as potential participants in the collective conversation, right? So I wonder if you could clarify kind of how you see this argument in this book in relationship to identity politics. Okay. All right.
I, too, would like to start by saying how privileged I feel to participate in this conversation and by thanking Mark for organizing the event and inviting me to be on the panel. I am honored to be breathing this room's rarefied political science air. I make no claims, however, to any political theory acumen. I'm here to testify just a little to this work's value for other fields, certainly that of gender studies, where I'm fortunate to count Ella as a colleague, but more specifically that of disability studies in which I work. The astoundingly lucid worldly ethics has several extremely desirable traits. Let me mention three.
First, it is both succinct and authoritative. As it tackles Foucault or Levinas or Arendt, the book retains a strong sense of itself and its goals, exhibiting a welcome capacity to synthesize and distill. I nod in sad trepidation at the statement that Foucault's work on ancient ethics is often quite dense, consisting of detailed analyses of sometimes obscure texts, but I greet with relief the assertion that it is nonetheless possible to identify four distinguishing features. Thank God. As the book synthesizes and distills with panache, its expert tone nonetheless assures us of the validity of its representations. Worldly ethics feels like the tip of an ethical iceberg, as if its author had carefully mapped a frozen Foucauldian, Levinasian, and Arendtian, not sure if that's a word, block, and then rearranged its components so the most pertinent elements rose above the surface for our viewing pleasure, still evidently supported by the breadth and depth of the work that lies beneath. Second, worldly ethics is unafraid. Without fanfare, without fuss, it fairly summarizes and then contests theoretical insights. For instance, Ella initially affirms William Connolly's optimistic revision of Foucauldian self-care as he, quote, seems to provide what Foucault does not, a way of conceptualizing the link between the care for the self and politics that is not premised on a dynamic of mastery. Ella dismantles such seeming, however, with simple, powerful, critical questions. Quote, how does such activity, which Connolly presents as integral to democratic practice, get off the ground? What ensures that self-intervention, if enacted, will result in dispositions that enhance, rather than endanger, democratic engagement? Why assume that the turn inward will give way to a turn outward? Ella notes that in one of Connolly's own examples, an individual's ethical self-remaking in relation to death is precipitated by something worldly, a new political movement claiming a right to die. Yet, she goes on, Connolly inconsistently describes action by the self on itself as a necessary prelude to macro-political change. There is real delight in being helped both to understand the value and potential of Connolly's adaptation of Foucault and to see in his work the elisions that this book will address. Third, worldly ethics is beautifully pieced together. Each section is of a piece, guiding us through ideas about self-care, care for the other, and care for the world. The structuring of each paragraph, subsection, chapter produces a pleasurable forward and outward impulse, neatly emulating the turn toward the world the book encourages. We thus feel as if we have made it home in chapter 4, where appropriately the world is configured by Ella as a shared home that we produce in our debates about worldly things. One way to measure a theoretical work's value is in its relevance for a set of concerns the author did not particularly have in mind. That is, the value of Ella's book should be understood almost entirely in its possible relevance to my own work. Obviously. To that end, a few observations about the compelling connections worldly ethics provides to disability studies. The political rhetoric employed in parts of worldly ethics is sometimes at odds with conventions of gender or disability studies. Most obvious, perhaps, is the different definition these fields give to a term like normative, which in gender studies refers to hegemonic forces that impel variant identities toward gender and sexual norms, as in heteronormative. Similarly, in disability studies, the term reflects compulsion toward an embodied norm that ignores or stigmatizes physical and mental variance. In political science, however, and in worldly ethics, the term normative merely implies, as Ella glossed it for me in a recent email, prescriptive, referring to, quote, a kind of theory that makes recommendations about what ought to be done. The anxiety of disability scholars about the medicalizing and normalizing effects of even such kindly prescription, itself a term with curative connotations, might be compounded by worldly ethics' opening pages, which note that political theories turn to ethics has been seen by others rather than Ella herself as, quote, an indispensable treatment for a crippled democratic politics, as helping cure what ails democratic life, and as diagnosing the ills affecting liberal democracies. A disability perspective might object to an ethics modeled metaphorically on an able body that has cast off crippledness, ailments, and ills. Perhaps it is not so far from such rhetoric to assumptions that the crippled and ill are incapable of proper participation in an ethical, democratic sphere. In contrast, the book's trajectory through criticisms of models of self-care and care for the other coincides remarkably with disability concerns. In chapter one, Ella critiques Foucault's concept of self-care as too solipsistic a model for ethical democratic politics. She asserts, quote, "A viable democratic ethos should focus less on inciting and enriching individual care for oneself than on activating collaborative concern for social conditions." In similar ways, disability scholars censure the narratives of individual overcoming that dominate common representations of disabled people, the blind man who climbs Everest, for instance, which affirm disabled individuals' obligation to transform themselves rather than illuminating environmental and social inequities. Ella points out, too, that Foucault's earlier disciplinary work raises questions as to what extent self-care might be less a practice of freedom and more the quiet, light operation of disciplinary power. From a disability perspective, the claim that self-control and self-governance are prerequisites for access to citizenship and freedom appears to exclude from citizenship and freedom the disabled subject, perceived as dysfunctional and erratic. Indeed, the disabled subject gives the lie to the possibility that anyone can preserve the self as autonomous and whole, and thus his exclusion permits a disavowal that underwrites hierarchy and oppression. In chapter two, Levinas's ethical self is perhaps valuably attuned to the suffering needs of a vulnerable other in ways that might open democratic engagement with other others. But as Ella comments, this model founded on a charitable relationship is hierarchical and non-reciprocal, obscures structural causes of deprivation, and privileges individual interactions over associational politics. Ella's appraisal thus resonates with disability rights movements against charity and pity models, the telethon model, that construes disabled people as passive, suffering, and infantilized, pathetically awaiting their only hope, a cure. Here, too, the disabled self seems precluded from active ethical participation, trapped in the position of the needy other. In turn, the moves of chapters 3 and 4 resonate with disability studies' reimagining of disability as a vital facet of what Ella terms the worldly, quote, "the array of material and immaterial conditions under which human beings live, both with one another and with a rich variety of non-humans, organic and technological." The process Ella maps in Chapter 3, whereby collectives form to articulate a wrong to be redressed and make themselves of some account through public presentation of a worldly thing, aptly describes the independent living movement in the U.S. in the 1970s, which pointed out how welfare and educational structures discouraged disabled people from entry into universities or the workforce. It describes, too, the Capitol crawl of 1990, in which physically disabled activists, determined to hasten the passage of the ADA, shed wheelchairs and crutches at the base of the Capitol stairs and crawled their way to the top. But it is Chapter 4 that brings the intervention most profound from a disability viewpoint. Here, Ella mandates making the world a hospitable home through the provision of basic needs for all. In discussing basic needs, Ella importantly refuses the implications of Arendt and assertions of Nussbaum that such needs are self-evident to certain experts, can be specified once and for all, and must be cordoned off from the realm of political debate. As was made evident by the independent living movement, historic assumptions about the basic needs of disabled people have been vehemently challenged by disabled people in recent decades. Moreover, it's clear that past delineations of those needs contained disabled people as passive recipients of welfare or charity and worked to preclude them from participation in the public democratic sphere. As well as making the world hospitable through meeting basic needs, then, Ella argues we must also make possible the kinds of inclusive democratic gatherings that can produce the world as an intermediary that both connects and differentiates us. This world is one of openness, reciprocity, and respect for difference. Writes Ella, drawing on Arendt, "To express one's doxa in the presence of other citizens is to reveal the world as it opens itself to me." This revelation affirms distance, on the one hand, because the world opens itself differently to every individual. At the same time, the expression of what appears to me also affirms the existence of a world which opens to everyone and thus links us together. This rhetoric of openness again converges with recent disability commentary. Rosemary Garland Thompson's 2012 article, The Case for Conserving Disability, argues that efforts to master our genetic future, especially by eradicating certain kinds of impairment, constitutes a, quote, loss of openness to forces and events outside the self. She calls instead for the conservation of disability as an ethical and epistemological resource, as an acceptance of the unexpected, which enables us to, quote, build solidarity with others, cultivate human sympathies, and create an open human community in which we live in the given world that the present bequeaths, rather than a gated community writ large of our scrupulously managed future. The vision of disability as a resource worthy of conservation was likely not in Ella's purview as she wrote Worldly Ethics, and might even be something she herself would dispute. The power of her vision of ethical debate is that it makes space for such a view in commending and commanding an inclusive public discourse that does not separate what we deem self-evident from what is up for debate. Still, insofar as the book is prescriptive about ethical debates, I wonder what kinds of debate it ultimately prescribes. That is, while we cannot predetermine the content of our ethical debates, what can and should we specify about the form they take? Must our debates in town halls, at protests, in the comments section of a Tribune article meet certain requirements of receptiveness or politeness to facilitate collective caring for the world? Worldly Ethics notes that contemporary political debates can seem aggressive, closed-minded, and unlikely to contribute to meaningful discussion or reflection. Ella cites as an example the town hall meetings held early in Barack Obama's administration, where, quote, citizens yelled angrily over one another while frequently likening Obama to Hitler. She cites, too, the vitriolic and racist utterances of Tea Party protesters in late 2009. Although the book's push toward making the world hospitable appears to frown on such hostile actions, I am unsure whether these actions constitute violations of care for the world, and thus obstructions of ethical democracy, or merely indicate a necessary diversity of opinion and expression. I wonder, then, do loud and angry interjections invalidate the ethical political process? Or is it the content of such interjections, perhaps racist or misogynist, that is suspect and in some sense unworldly? Or is it the intention or effect that renders these utterances unethical in that they foreclose rather than facilitate exchange of diverse opinions? What structural conditions must be met to ensure polite and politic debate? And what of unruly bodies and behaviors shaped by disability, different ways of being in the world that may appear in a normalized space as obstructions to or disruptions of reasoned debate? In what resides the difference between the badly behaved Tea Partiers and disabled people who may think or act in ways that violate social norms premised on the image of democracy as a healthy and thus ethical body? What behaviors do or do not belong in those spaces where we explore our common and dividing world? Disability scholar Alison Kafer notes that in the utopia of Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time, the desirability of eliminating certain physical or mental variations is assumed. But the entrance of disabled people into political discourse has contested such self-evident assumptions and reframed disability as a vital experience of human contingency and variation, a development Worldly Ethics would, I think, affirm as politically ethical. But what is the content of Worldly Ethics' prescription? And to the extent it prescribes the form of ethical interaction, what kinds of behaviors or appearances are implicitly anathema to ethical process? I am interested then in the parameters of the ethical kinds of democratic interaction Worldly Ethics commends, and of the possible spaces it allows for those for whom a crippled democracy might be precisely the kind they desire.
Well, I knew when I organized this panel that there'd be no chance that we would repeat each other when it came to our critical rejoinders to the book, and I'm pleased to be confirmed in that view. Now, I've already said a lot of nice things about the book. I just want that to be noted, that I said all the nice things at the beginning, and now it's my job to be more critically minded about it. But I'm going to keep these comments very short, because I can just feel that Ella has never been forced to be this quiet this long. And I'm beginning to feel pain coming from that direction. So I do want to keep this short. Because I also want to hear what the rest of you make of all of this. But just to say a few things about this. Now, in my view, Myers has convincingly shown that you can care for your soul and you can care for another, a needy other, very deeply, and still be held responsible for not giving a heck, we can say heck, not giving a heck about the world. And that one can be held culpably accountable for that. And furthermore, that a political theory worthy of the name should not be satisfied with that kind of a result. If it empties in therapeutic care, or if it results in hierarchical relationships of charity, it's not properly a political theory. Sign me up. I'm with her on all of that. Care for the world, in other words, is a deeply necessary, perhaps overdue, kind of political orientation. But let me now try to indicate what I think is a tension in the way in which the concept of ethos is being used in this work. And whether I'm right or wrong about this, it may at least prompt some further discussion for all of us. And the most general way that I can put this question is as follows. Can you have a worldly ethics without self-consciously seeking to shape personal character? Can ethos reliably exist without soulcraft, the kind of thing that liberals, foundational or post-foundational, don't like? And if it cannot, if you cannot have ethos without a kind of formative, educative, crafting experience, how can you have both? And how can they both be defended today under conditions of pluralism? Now, I ask this question in the first place because I wonder about the relationship between the associative model of democracy that Professor Myers values and the normative ethics of self-cultivation that she's critical of, and you've heard a bit about that. In departing from Foucault and departing from Levinas, she treats ethos as something that is not intrasubjective, not something we work on in ourselves, and she treats ethos not as something intersubjective, something that we do together, but rather as something she calls extra-subjective. That is to say, this is an ethos that goes on within associations, not between or within persons. It's extra-subjective. My question is whether we're still talking about ethos, that is, character, ethical dispositions, virtues and vices, when ethos is conceived as something that exists outside of subjects. I ask this question also for some practical reasons as well, because the world is, after all, a very hard thing for us to love. I don't think that's a newsflash, but many religions, for example, many religious traditions explicitly warn us against loving the world. To love the world is to be mistaken in the proper objects of one's love. Many of the daily facts of our lives prompt feelings of alienation, resentment, and hatred toward the world, and the complexities of our social and material world incite not love but withdrawal, deference, and so on. Taken together, these disparate cultural elements about the world are not just substitutes for democratic worldly care, but actually forms of outright social and moral opposition to just that sentiment. Now, if you accept that as a potential problem, as a potential description of the way millions of citizens mediate themselves to the world, then there might be a need to provide a strong theoretical and practical defense of moral and civic education alongside the elaboration of worldly care in order to catalyze and to sustain this ethos beyond the relatively small number of cases that are described in this book. There are cases of worldly care and worldly love for democratic politics, but they're noteworthy by their marginality. And by the fact that so few of you will have known about them until you read Ella. But that sort of flags the problem, it seems to me. Now, the theoretical heroes of this book, and I think they are Dewey, Arendt, and Tocqueville to a certain degree, all made education, and in some cases an explicitly political education, a central part of their treatment and their advocacy of democracy. Now, to be sure, there are barriers, a lot of barriers, to this type of politicized education today. But I wonder whether Professor Myers would agree with the proposition that these barriers must be actively resisted both within and outside the academy in order to encourage a worldly democratic politics, or whether that kind of ethical and political cultivation risks a kind of normalization that Angela was speaking to, a kind of normalization that we should avoid for the sake of human diversity and of human freedom. And with that question, no minor one, I grant, I'm going to invite Ella to respond. Yes?
Sure.
Okay, very good. So we're gonna give Ella the floor, and then we're going to open it up to all of you. Okay? Ella.
Well, first of all, thank you all for being here. I feel incredibly honored. And a special thank you to everybody on the panel. You know, writing is such a laborious and often solitary activity that it really is just such a pleasure to realize that one's words are out in the world and there are actual readers, and not just any readers, but these really smart, careful, provocative readers. So I'm just delighted. This is a real pleasure. So I have the distinct disadvantage of not having heard any of these comments until just now. So as opposed to these, you know, beautifully crafted remarks that you've just heard, I am doing this on the fly. So I'm, you know, if you want my more polished ruminations, you can pick up the book. If you want my sort of, you know, sputtering stops and starts, here we go. So you've all given me a ton to think about. There's no way I can sort of do justice to all the questions you've raised. I did want to start, though, I guess, with one of what I took to be one of Edmund's main concerns. And if I understood you correctly, you actually posed this in several different forms through a couple of your questions, which I think I heard you asking when you asked this question about is this account sufficiently political, when you were asking about whether there is anything that's guaranteed about this kind of ethics, and then when you were asking about whether it maybe participates in fostering an illusion of democratic engagement. I sort of heard those questions as being tied together by a concern for maybe the relations of power that are either concealed by or kind of not fully addressed through the idiom of worldly ethics. I'm not sure if that's a fair gloss on what you said, but if that's along the right lines, let me just say a couple things about that. I mean, one of the things I've tried to do in the book when I'm thinking about democratic association is not to reduce association to simply cooperative endeavors, right? So there is a way of thinking about association that we're all familiar with, which has to do with a group of people getting together and trying to pursue, you know, some kind of goal that they have in common. And that is a valuable form of association. In the book, I refer to that as solidarity or solidaristic association. But when I talk about association, I'm also talking about something much more contentious than that. And that's what I refer to in the book as the public, which is, you know, the sort of space or set of relations in which you have all different kinds of, you know, individuals, groups, associations vying with each other over these worldly things, which are common, common to them, but common in the precise sense of being contested, being objects of dispute, not because they all, you know, agree on what should be done or because they're all sort of, you know, speaking in unanimity. So, I mean, that is one of the ways that I try to get at the sense that this is a kind of politics that is rooted in struggle. I mean, I realize I use that language a lot in the book because I'm trying to guard against a sort of, you know, overly kind of optimistic or romanticized version of what collective action entails. It's difficult, taxing, uncertain labor. And so I do try to capture that. Along these same lines, I was struck by your point about the language of citizenship that I rely on in the book. And you saying that gave me one of those moments where I wished I'd added a paragraph that isn't there. But I was very self-conscious about using that language, and of course, particularly in relation to contemporary immigration debates, that language is very loaded. When I talk about citizenship in the book, I'm talking about citizenship as a practice. So I'm not talking about citizenship merely as a formal status. I mean, that's one way we think of citizenship, like, do you have the papers that show you're a citizen? But I'm much more interested in a form of activity that we could regard as citizenly. And, you know, there's certainly other theorists who've spent much more time thinking about this than I have. But, for example, we have lots of contemporary examples of immigration-related protests that embody the kind of associative democracy I'm after, but many of the participants in those protests are not technically, formally U.S. citizens, right? So I appreciate you bringing that up, and again, it was one of those moments where I wish I still had another round of edits to do so I could try to bring out specifically how I'm using that language of citizenship. Okay, I think I'm going to move... I'm obviously not addressing everything. The idea is that we'll have time for conversation. If there's things that folks brought up that you're dying to hear about that I haven't tended to, we'll have a chance for that. So Angela, your remarks really just made me excited about sort of a whole new terrain of kind of reading and thinking that I'd like to do. So I was just really struck by your very generous reading of my work and the kind of new vistas that you opened up in terms of thinking about worldly ethics in connection to disability politics. So I really feel like most of what I have to say to you is like, I want a reading list and I want to sort of think about this more when I have the time and the attention to devote to it. But I did think your kind of big question is a really important one, which was this question about sort of what exactly am I prescribing or kind of disallowing in terms of this worldly ethic? So what am I both calling for and then what am I kind of ruling out or casting as kind of, you know, unacceptable or not the normative direction that my project wants to go? And I mean, the most pointed, I think you put that as what counts as a violation of this ethics. And then you asked whether our sort of debates must meet certain requirements. And it seemed like you were talking about that. You mentioned, you know, that in terms of sort of, you know, what we might think of as kind of procedural or stylistic constraints, right? You talked about politeness or responsiveness, or is it also about the very content of the kinds of claims we're making? I mean, and I do think this issue of sort of style is something I should think more about. I have to tell you, and this probably comes as no surprise to anybody in the room who knows me, when you said polite, I just cringed. Like, I am not in the business of, you know, of sort of recommending kind of more civic discourse, you know, that whole worry about civility and sort of the decline of, I mean, I think oftentimes that's a really anti-political discourse, and so that is really not where I would want to go with this. I would say, you know, as much as I sort of would want to question the kind of content style divide, I'd have to say, at least as far as my thinking's gone at this point, my project is more concerned with sort of what is the content of the claims being made, right? And so in that final chapter where I'm talking about caring for the world as world, which is part of what you were talking about, thinking of the world both as a shared home and thinking about what material conditions are required so that all human beings and not just some human beings have their needs met within that shared home, and then also thinking of the world as this intermediary force. I would say in both of those, I'm trying to marshal those as kind of substantive ends, substantive norms by which to make distinctions between competing movements. Because of course, you know, when I give the account of what I call worldly things, or this argument that sort of all associative activity is directed at this contentious object, that can sound so open-ended as to be indiscriminate, right? Like, well, any organization of people then is in some sense engaged in this kind of worldly politics if they're all arguing over some worldly thing. And so it really is the kind of notion of shared home and intermediary or in between that is doing the kind of more prescriptive work that I think you were asking for. And so far as I've been thinking about that, that has more to do with what are the kinds of demands or claims being made? What is being called for? And are they claims or demands? So, for example, with your Tea Partiers versus disability rights activists, are the demands being made demands that would make the world more of a hospitable home for all people or not? And I think, I mean, the racism alone of some of the claims that I was citing would disqualify that. Whereas the claims of disability rights activists, as you brought out, I think are very much in keeping with this sense that the world needs to be a home to all persons in all of their multiplicity and diversity. Okay, I'm going to make one more comment in response to Mark, and then we're going to have a chat. Okay, so... Oh, right. So Mark's big question had to do with whether ethos can really be sort of separated from this question of soulcraft, meaning the kind of cultivation of individual sort of character, disposition, sensibility. And isn't that a sort of essential component of the worldly ethos that I... am advocating? And I think the short answer to that is yes. In the book, I try to make it clear that it's not that I'm dismissing that question of self-cultivation altogether. I'm concerned with the way that certain ethical understandings of self-cultivation treat that relationship with the self as the starting point, as the privileged site of activity, so that we sort of assume that by having a certain reflexive relationship with ourselves, we then move outward from that into these more worldly relations. And part of the claim I'm making is that if we are even going to think of those sites, sort of worldly relations and the self relation, as reciprocal, then we ought to treat it as truly reciprocal, which is that the cultivation of those worldly conditions is also vital for the proper kind of self cultivation, right? So if we're after what Connolly, for example, is after, which are you know, sort of more open, generous, less materialistic human beings, then we need to create the conditions under which those human beings are more likely to emerge, right? So this is an argument, like, if those of you who've read Michael Warner and The Trouble with Normal, you know, this is an argument he makes about queer counterpublics, right? If we're interested in new subjectivities, that's not something that emerges on its own in isolation by an individual crafting themselves. It's because there are queer counterpublics that make possible those kinds of alternative subjectivities. So my main point would just be that those things need to always be sort of thought together. And I know you know that that's what I think, but my other comment would just be that I think your point about civic education is really intriguing. I mean, this isn't a direction I've gone in very much, and I know you and Trisha, there's lots of people in my department I could talk to if this is the way I want to go. I mean, I think you're right that that's kind of the frontier in which one might be able to imagine kind of more sweeping, more like you said, less sort of one-off sort of marginal examples of worldly ethics, but a kind of more robust and wide-reaching effort. As you already noted, that carries certain risks with it as well. I guess the one thing I would say, just my initial kind of cautionary worry, would be that I think there is a tendency when, at least in existing sort of civic education, there's a tendency to operate at the register of what I call charitable ethics. So a lot of the kind of volunteerism that if it's even fostered, but when that's fostered in public schools, it's directed at a kind of hierarchical, charitable practice that I argue in the book is not just non-political, but actually anti-political. And so I would, you know, it would have to be a very sort of carefully sort of, you know, thought out and designed curriculum that would not lapse into that problem that I track. So those are my initial thoughts. I would love to hear from other people.